Dick Cavett. You may know me as a talk show host, sometime actor, and rarely state champion gymnast on the pommel horse in Nebraska. Anyway, I'm talking to Dave Lefkowitz, and the program is called Dave's Gone By, and we're on UNC Radio. U for uvula, N for Nelly, C for crap.
Exactly, which is what we shovel weekly on the program, yes.
Okay. I was warned that some Lefkowitz would be calling, and I assumed it wasn't the old...
It wasn't Louis. He's gone.
He was attorney... What was he?
Yeah, attorney general. No relation, unfortunately, but...
Yeah, I upset him once.
How did you upset Louis Lefkowitz? You didn't say something anti-Semitic, did you? No.
No. I was involved in a scandal at the time with... I had a very questionable accountant, and I got into a thing with the Indian Museum, this is going back years, where they had let me have some things in exchange for some money that they needed to buy something in their collection they didn't have. Anyway, the Louis found out about it.
Yeah?
I wasn't the only one, but naturally I was all over the New York Post.
Oh, well, naturally, yeah. This was the Museum of the American Indian or a different museum?
Yeah, back when it was way uptown.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And anyway, my joke was, they said, well, what's your final comment on this to Mr. Lefkowitz? And I said, I think it's a tempest in a teepee.
Oh, that's very good.
And it's a good joke, and I was told that he hit the ceiling when he heard it.
Oh, well.
So that shows that a joke can have a desired effect.
Well, what's the corollary to that joke, that Louis Lefkowitz then went to his psychiatrist and he said, Dick Cavett, he's just making me boiling mad. He keeps telling me about these two teepees, it's driving me crazy. And the psychiatrist says, now I know your problem, you're too tense.
Oh, that's wonderful. You should be a gag writer. Maybe you are.
In a manner of speaking, yeah, I make people gag with my writing.
But, oh, wait a minute. There's an ancient joke, too old for you to remember. I think it was vaudeville.
Yeah?
A book I had. And A says, do you know what an Indian summer is? And B says, that's when the heat is intense.
Ho-ho! Yeah, I didn't make the intense. I just adapted it to Louis Lefkowitz.
You channeled into a very good joke and get full credit for it.
That's all. Yeah, come on. How many jokes are there? There's 10 storylines in the whole world, and every screenplay is based on all of them.
They claim.
Yeah.
Nobody's ever revealed what they are, but.
Oh, probably Robert McKee did at some point, but.
Somebody must have.
A literal broadcast legend. Someone that anyone who is in this business or even on the fringes of this business admires, looks to the archives for, to see how this is done. How do you interview people? How do you hold a microphone for half an hour and I don't mean just physically in your hand. I mean hold the audience to you and keep you there with the way you phrase things, with the way you ask questions, with the wit and with the charm and the intelligence. No one really, and I would even include people like Steve Allen and David Letterman and the great Irv Kupchinet. Nobody does it or has done it like our guest in the neighborhood, Dick Cavett. For 30 years on various networks, he hosted his own talk and interview and variety show. He's also an actor. He has come from Yale Drama School. He was a writer for The Tonight Show. And most recently, of the many, many things that he does and has done, he is playing himself in a theatrical recreation of history. He was in a play a couple of seasons ago off-Broadway, and now public television is doing a wonderful thing. They're broadcasting off-Broadway plays. And one of them was called Hellman versus McCarthy, all about a big literary feud that we'll talk about. It happened on television. It happened on Dick Cavett's show. And now, many years later, he was off-Broadway recreating that as part of it. Very strange, very interesting, and again, very honored and thrilled to have Dick Cavett in the neighborhood. Welcome, Dick. How you doing?
Well, I'm disappointed. I couldn't wait to hear who it was you were introducing.
That's right. I thought it was going to be Benjamin Disraeli, but I got you instead. Oh, well. Oh, well. I'm thrilled anyway.
Wait, can you hear a dog barking?
I certainly can now, yes. Yes.
First dog you've had on your show, I'm not referring to certain guests that way.
What kind of dog do you have?
We don't know. He's an ARF dog. He's a rescued from a kennel in St. Louis somewhere that was going to kill all their dogs.
Oh.
And ARF rescued him, brought them here, and my dog Riley is the best of them all.
Oh, well, I believe in ARF for ARF's sake, actually. I'm sorry, that was really...
Is it too late to get the rabbi?
Actually, it's not. If this really goes downhill, the rabbi is in the next room. So we have him there in abeyance.
Having with an earphone waiting for his signal. The only error you made, and it's remarkable, is totally unserious, in that, yes, I took courses in the Yale Drama School, but while I was an undergraduate. So I can't really say the way Paul Newman, Julie Harris, a lot of eminent people, that I graduated from the drama school. I just got to sit in on some classes there. But
the reason you didn't graduate there was because you were already in the business selling jokes? Was that, or why not?
It's just that I was in my third or fourth year in the undergraduate school, and they'd gotten a lot of complaints. Now, Yale obviously doesn't have acting classes, so they let students who were interested in that take courses in the grad school as part of their day.
Oh.
So I got to do that, and it was wonderful.
What did you get your degree in then, by the way?
Very old English major.
An English major, wow. Dare I tell you that I teach English right now, so that's kind of...
been a good tradition. Both of my parents were English teachers. In fact, three of them. My stepmother also was. So my life was always... they gave it to him and her. She and I went to the movie. And
oh, God.
She went to the movie, and I went to the movie, and me went to the movie, and, you know, whatever. I was always being corrected that way.
We went but with her, know. With he, she, yeah. Who's at the door? It is I. No, it's me. Yeah, that sort of thing.
Well, the great Dwight MacDonald said only a prig would insist that somebody say it is I when someone knocks, when you knock at the door. So even... that great language expert said, it's me, it's okay for us Philistines or Steens.
Well, it's okay for us, not we Philistines, for us. But I go through this every day, and so did your parents. So they, I assume, conveyed a real love of language and literature in you?
Very much, yeah. I was read to a lot as a very small kid. And also I was one of those who precociously had been reading for 2 years when I went to kindergarten. So this led to an unfortunate trait in my personality.
Which is?
Bold, that when the other kids had to learn to read when I already knew how, and they did so poorly, I don't know how to tell you this.
Tell it, because I feel like I was doing the exact same thing. Go ahead.
Well, I am told that I sometimes held my ears when the other kids read.
Oh, my God. Did you get beaten?
I hope so. I certainly should have. On the spot.
Oh, I was bullied like crazy, and now I realize why.
Yeah.
So, hey, by the way, did you have a favorite book that your parents used to read to you? I'm just curious.
Yeah, Treasure Island.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Wow.
I had to read that to me every year, I think, for several years.
And what about in your... somewhat late in your teen years and 20s, like this, the college school age years, did you have a book that just blew your mind?
Well, I had the usual love affair with Scott Fitzgerald and Gatsby.
Why do people love that book so much?
I don't know. You know, I was thinking of reading it again to see if I can figure that out.
Yeah. I mean, I read it, okay. I think kids like it because it's relatively short for a novel and easier than Jane Austen, but I don't know.
You know it's good, and yet I couldn't tell you why. But next time we talk, maybe I will have
That's a deal.
And as people say about books they haven't even read in the first place.
Well, okay, how's about a book that you've read in the past 5 or 10 years that really blew your mind? Fiction or non?
Yeah, right at the moment I'm eager to get back, and don't take this personally.
Okay.
To the page I was on when the phone rang.
Okay.
And John Lahr's tremendous Tennessee Williams biography.
Oh my God, I've read Lahr's stuff on Joe Orton, and he also wrote about Dame Edna. He has a very good biography.
And recently about Al Pacino, brilliantly.
Oh really? Oh wow. So he's been busy with that stuff. Yeah, John is a very brilliant critic for The New Yorker, and cool. I only know him tangentially, but if I see him, I'll tell him, Dick Cavett loves your book. Yay!
Yeah, I did. He knows that. I saw him the other night at the 92nd Street Y, and I told him that. I did quite a few shows with Tennessee, and he was a fabulous character, but there are so many things in this book, including what some will find as startling details of his private life.
Oh, well, yeah, okay. Such as? I haven't read it. Uh-oh. Well, we're on college radio, you can say.
I don't want to spoil it for you. I don't want to reveal any endings, so to speak.
Do you really? I know you haven't gotten to the end of the book, but does he choke to death on a pen cap or a bottle cap? Was that how he went?
He asked me that before I heard John on radio last week.
Uh-huh.
And he said yes. And that's the received story. And that's how it was reported in the New York Times and everywhere else. No, he killed himself with overdose. And somehow, someone fractured that or manipulated it into the thing you and I obviously both heard, that he either choked on the cap or the...
Yeah, because he was leaning back. He was just taking his regular dosage. And the bottle cap went into his throat and that was it.
That's
what you're saying,
no. Yeah, not true. And you're right, I haven't gotten to the end. And John said, when he answered a question from the audience that night, he said, I could have answered that better because I wrote this 2 years ago. I can't remember all the details, but they're all laid out. It's the surprise, I guess, at the end of the book.
Well, I'm sorry I've kind of spoiled... Well, he spoiled it for you before I did.
But don't let that keep you from reading it.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, speaking of books we read when we were younger, I'm sure you had to read... maybe after your time, but A Separate Piece by John Knowles, and that thing that you would do when you were a senior and you knew that juniors were going to be reading that book, and 20 pages before the end, kids were right at the top of the page, Finney dies, which is kind of the lead character there, just to spoil it for people who don't realize that the main character is going to die in 20 pages.
Or the maid did it on a Ruth Rendell mystery.
Yeah. Exactly. Now, speaking of reading and books and stuff like that, if you had to read books, and I'm sure you've read both of them, whom did you prefer? Did you like the plays of Lillian Hellman or the books of Mary McCarthy?
Well, I like both in their separate ways. I like Mary's pieces and her things like her Paris Review interview and essays and also fiction, the memories of Catholic girlhood and the other stuff. That one was not fiction, of course. But her writing in almost every field was, to me, lovely to read. I first didn't meet her, but heard her lecture when I was at Yale, and she was wonderful.
You're still talking about Hellman or McCarthy now?
Sorry, all up to this point I've been talking about McCarthy.
McCarthy, okay, got it.
There's a fabulous essay. I think maybe I worked this into the play one night earlier this year. In the scene where Mary and Cabot are on the air together, and it just occurred to me, and I just threw it into the play that she was writing about some of the dreadful teaching in the school she was teaching in at the time.
Uh huh.
She had an English major girl say to her at the end of some meeting, I have to go now. I'm meeting Professor Lefkowitz, and we are going to take my short story, and he is going to help me put the symbols in it.
Okay. I mean, I kind of understand what that's meaning.
It is to make up symbols and put them.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't think it was going to be musical instruments because that would be a very noisy essay. But. But I'm bum. Cymbal crash on that joke. What about Lillian Hellman, her plays?
I always enjoyed Hellman's books. And because she was a very, very good storyteller. Bogus as hell, at least half the time. But I didn't know that at the time, so I could innocently think that there was a Julia and that Hellman did take money in her hat in the dangerous area and do all these heroic things she does in the book Julia, which turns out to be a total fabrication.
Now, let me ask you right then and there, how much does that matter? I mean, is Julia called an autobiography?
Not at all. And it was silly of the old bag not to call it that, because it reads well, and she decided, but she couldn't resist making herself the heroine. I mean, she could have published it as a novel, I mean.
Exactly. That's what. So do we run into the issue of, say, that book from a few years back, Three Cups of Tea, if you've heard about that, that guy who was going to these, I guess, Afghanistan and these countries that despise us and helping them. Did you read the? Are you familiar with that book?
I remember the sort of scandal about it, but not the details.
Well, yeah, he was going over there trying to build schools and schools for girls in these heavily dark, hateful Islamic countries and going through imprisonment and trying to bring a little bit of Western light into these darkened cultures. And he apparently lied about tons of details.
Yeah, he wrote some of it probably in the Dixie Hotel in New York or something.
Right. So how much of a problem should we have with that if it's a good book?
Say that again?
Oh, I'm sorry. If it's a good book, comma, how much of a problem should we have with that kind of...
Well, you should have the exact problem of, is it true or not?
Okay, so that is a huge deal.
Certainly enjoy it, not knowing. I'm sure there are people who lived and died and read Julia, didn't know what a bald-faced liar Lillian Hellman was, particularly about her not still being a member of the Communist Party for the rest of her life. Ooh. And probably enjoyed it just fine, but it's a sick thing to do. It's a deception.
Hmm.
And
okay.
What could be done?
Now, let me ask, when Lillian Hellman and Mary McCarthy went on your show, did you have any idea of what was brewing before the kettle boiled over?
First of all, they were never on the show together, though some people...
Oh!
Maybe they were. No, they were both on the show at separate times, and Lillian had been on a couple times and been a very good guest, and we were quite cordial, and I even had dinner at her house one night. I found it a little odd that she had the book critic of the New York Times over for dinner.
Okay.
Who can blame her? But it was simply me and Mary.
Mm-hmm.
Oates had said she might like to take a moment, if you will do it, to praise a young writer she has discovered who she feels is very good but underpraised. So I thought of that in the middle of the show, and I threw a cue where she could praise this young writer who was underpraised, and she didn't catch it.
Hmm.
And so I thought, was that in my notes? And I threw it again, and she didn't. And so, it just sort of in transition, in a throwaway way, I said maybe we could talk about some overpraised writers, and expected to move right on to the next subject when she said,
"Everything that Mary McCarthy
Lillian Hellman as
Lillian Hellman, sorry, yeah,
as the overpraised writer, and said her immortal quote, and this is how she pronounced it: she's such a dishonest writer that." Even her ands and thes are lives. I may be wrong. She may have said these, but it sounds better to say thes.
Because these could be another word. Yeah, yeah.
The word and the word the are lives was the joke. And significantly ahead of that, she had said, as I said in an interview once.
Oh.
Interview, as it happened, the very same, then said the very same thing. Well, I learned from the legal eagle of mine when Lillian sued everybody in sight, including me, that I said, but wait a minute, this has already been out there. It was in a that the printed word doesn't defend you at all.
Hmm.
In other words, he said, look, that doesn't help. Nobody reads.
Even back then, I mean, compared to now, let alone, even then the video was taking over and people are out
obviously
there.
Obviously that means that if she'd said it on my show before or somebody else's, you couldn't now sue her for it.
But what charge did she sue the show? I mean, I can understand suing Mary McCarthy for slander or libel.
I don't know, augmenting something that destroyed her reputation, that slandered her, that held her up to ridicule in front of her friends. All these things are in the play.
Now, after that happened, and I haven't seen the play, but did Lillian Hellman go back on your show?
No, she didn't.
So that was sort of she never countered, or she never responded, she just sued.
I never saw her again. No, she did kind of respond in that she called me the next day.
Yeah.
And said, and this is almost an exact interpretation of her pleasant telephone tone, why didn't you defend me?
Oh. Hmm.
And I said, as is in the play, love, I never think of you as anyone who needs defending. You do a pretty good job yourself with the gist of it. But she went on and...
And did you know at that point, though, that Mary McCarthy had a very serious point? Did you know then that Lillian Hellman was making up whole cloth of Julia and some other stuff?
Well, a lot of that had been exposed before, not only of Julia, but I think it was Martha Gellhorn, once known as Mrs. Ernest Hemingway number 2, was it? Who detailed, did real hard research on the Julia thing and found that this place didn't exist and that the train schedules couldn't have taken her where she went then, and just, you know, one after the other.
Yeah. So that was out there already.
Plot destroy. Yeah, the question was there already. And her veracity had been questioned quite frequently.
Did you ever, or when the lawsuit started flying, I assume you could not mention, did you ever say anything about it on the air? Or did the lawyers for the TV station just say, don't mention it, shut up, whatever?
No, nobody said anything to me legally at my home there on the PBS show.
Yeah.
Except the night of the show, and this gets a laugh in the play, where I say I went off stage, and the first person I saw was the PBS lawyer, whose job it is to be sure that nothing bad goes out over the air and so on and so on. And he looked at me and he said, nice show.
Hmm. Hmm. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not giving you the laugh that you get in the theater.
No, you can't laugh for millions. But she, obviously it was a joke, the idea that you would sue over this.
Well, then she would sue you, certainly, and sue the network. Suing McCarthy may be something else. I mean, damaging a reputation as a writer, etc.
The motive there was sinister, as so many of hers were, which was because Lillian was sitting on a mountain of wealth, not only from her pretty vast earnings from her plays, but also, and her books, but money she had inherited from Dashiell Hammett.
Right.
Whom she would have us think she lived with and was the indispensable item in his life for years and years and years, about which I asked Gore Vidal once, and he said, you know, it's funny, nobody ever saw them together.
Hey, that's an ideal relationship in some circles.
Yeah.
But so now, in the writing of this play, which, by the way, was performed by the Abingdon Theatre Company about a season or so ago, that is going to be broadcast this weekend.
I think it's a year yet.
I'm sorry, what?
I don't think it's a year ago yet.
Oh, sorry, it's fairly recent, just a few months old.
Yeah.
That the Off-Broadway and, well, even Off-Broadway, Abingdon Company did, and was filmed at the time for PBS. They're broadcasting it this weekend on both 13 in New York, WLIW on Long Island, and also you can, for our Colorado listeners, you can get it on the website. Sorry?
You have me at an odd moment, because I only learned today, somewhat to my chagrin, that it isn't on the network in the usual way. It is on WNET here, for all the lucky people in this area. Then I saw it's on WLIW on another night. It's on three nights coming up here. Three nights all. It will have been on three nights here.
But it's not syndicated. It's not on all PBS, which I found a disappointment. When I was looking at this series, it's not just one play, but...
people, they can see it. We can't.
Yeah, well, but that's the point. You can. I wanted to make sure.
Yeah, make that point.
Because they did London Wall from the Mint Theater last week, and then they've got Richard Nelson's three-play cycle coming up later in the season. So I want to make clear that you can go online, and I forget what the exact URL is, and watch the entire play once it's aired. It will be there, so you can watch it from your telephone, from your iPhone. Yeah.
Would Sorry? You do that by typing the title and then what in Googling?
Yeah, Google PBS or 13, the name of the play, Hellman v. McCarthy.
Yeah.
And hopefully, it will come up and you'll be able to watch literally the entire two-hour show or however long it runs. So anybody listening to the show...
No, and if you have trouble finding that, you could call WNET and say, how do I see it again? Hi, I'm Dick Cavett. You may know me as a talk show host, sometime actor, and rarely state champion gymnast on the pommel horse in Nebraska. Anyway, I'm talking to Dave Lefkowitz, and the program is called Dave's Gone By, and we're on UNC Radio.
Now, were you interviewed before? The writer of the play, I don't know if I have that in front of me. Who wrote it, the play? Dick?
Brian... Oh, God, wait, you have to... Brian Morey.
Brian Morey, okay. Wrote
That's
the
not the full name. There's a third part to Brian's name, and he uses the...
Brian Morey Eel, let's call him. You can Google that, folks. You can Google the author of the play. Forgive me for not having it in front of me.
How embarrassing.
I'm
committing harakiri.
When this fellow was writing the play, did he contact you, or you weren't even contacted until they started doing Hellman versus McCarthy? Were you interviewed as research, as a subject? Are you okay?
Are you asking me? I'm trying to check something that a note I made here.
Oh, sure.
Ask me again, and I'll tell you the answer.
Sure. The question was, this fellow is writing this play, this historical play based on these two people, and you had a part in it because they were on TV with you. Were you interviewed by the playwright during the course of his research, of his writing the play, or did you not hear about the play until it was already being pre-produced or produced?
You know, I don't precisely know the answer to that.
Hmm.
I just know that I was called, told about the play, asked if I wanted to do the somewhat dubiously wise thing of playing myself.
Uh-huh.
And immediate reaction was no, it's too hokey. And then I thought, you know, this could be good.
What is it like?
I left out of Brian Morey's name.
Oh, did you find it?
I remembered it. My memory clicked in. The way Freud says, don't press on it and it will come back. Ironically, what I left out of Brian blank Morey's name.
Yeah?
My name, Richard.
Oh, Brian Richard Morey. Okay, that does sound more familiar. Yeah. Brian Richard Morey's play, Hellman v. McCarthy. Okay. And as you said, you know, don't press on it and it will come back. Kind of like my prostate, in a manner of speaking.
Yeah, and what would a psychiatrist say about the fact that I left out my own name?
Hmm.
Extreme modesty? Lack of identity?
Or maybe you think, and I'm not trying to be a bad pun here, but maybe you think of yourself after all these years as Dick rather than Richard.
That's true, too, I do.
So,
only a few intimate friends, in that way they have, called you by your longer version of your name, if you have one. And Johnny Carson, whom I like very much, and me, I'm glad to say, would always say, good line, Richard.
Nice. Since you brought him up, I have to go there. I have to, you liked him. Obviously, you know, some people despised him. Joan Rivers loved him for a while. Then he cut her off, and she hated everything associated with The Tonight Show. So, but did you ever see that, the dark side of him, or you only saw the Good joke, Richard.
I only saw the good side of him because he was always good to me. That sounds like a mealy-mouthed thing to say, but the fact is we just got on so well. I would notice that he brightened when I came into his office. His staff would say, when I was on his show as a guest every time a Cabot show went off, and he'd say, if not this one, it's going to be Armed Forces Radio for Richard, would joke about that, and then his staff would say, I wish you were on every week, because he's just a different man.
Ooh.
In the nights that you're on.
That is a wonderful...
It's kind of touching, and I think it's more than... We just liked each other. In fact, we were both in Nebraska, may not have heard, but yeah, he was a tense man, a drinking man.
Oh.
And often had a wife on the ledge. And I often wondered the way he seemed in the afternoon versus the way he pulled himself together for the show so perfectly.
Interesting. You weren't like that. I assumed that you were just, in doing your show on different networks for all those years, that you were kind of the same all day, that you just read a lot, brushed up on the topic, read the book, or skimmed it as much as you could before you had a guest or two, and then, or were you different? Was the middle of the day very different?
I learned early that you don't have to read the guest's whole book to do an interview with them.
No, the inside cover, first chapter, skim, and then boom, you're good.
You read a 400-page book and then do 12 minutes with somebody in a show with three other guests. Unless you do 90 with them, then it's good to read it. But I would watch him stand back there when the Tonight Show theme played, and he was standing backstage ready to go on. And he would drop the Pall Mall he was smoking, the ones that killed him, stamp it out, and walk out there and just be happy as he could be for that time of his day.
Well, did that influence, sorry if this is kind of personal, but you have suffered depression through various periods of your life. Was it always for you that 60 minutes or that 90 minutes when, you felt like king of the world?
You can play through depression, fortunately.
Okay.
Mr. Marlon Brando made me look at a show of mine that I told him I couldn't. It would happen to be with Laurence Olivier.
Wow.
And I said, while I was doing it, I thought I was going to fall off the chair. I thought, these brilliant people can see that I'm nuts, that my brain is busted. I'm pausing probably for 10 seconds. Or even two is a long time between sentences. And he said, do me a favor. When you go back to New York, look at it. So I did, and I was fine.
Interesting.
I asked him, and he said, automatic pilot. We all get by on it sometimes.
Wow. Well, any thoughts on, there is a story on Wikipedia about you and Marlon Brando, and now I have to ask if that's true. Did you guys turn down a threesome with a comely young thing because you hadn't finished your meal at a restaurant yet? Is that really true?
Yeah, we had several bites of food left, and,
So a pretty young girl walks to the table, sees both of you, and says, I'm available for the evening for any kind of sexual delights, and you guys wanted to finish eating.
This is the part of my enthralling talk about Marlon Brando and me that you chose to focus.
The question is, it's not are you depressed? The question is, are you fucking crazy?
Or crazy fucking. what it was just exactly as you've described it. This young lady in a nicely dressed, not erotically dressed, just very, very nice, almost prim looking.
Those are the best. Sorry. Yes.
Who's the great French designer whose name I just blanked on? The white shirt and the blue skirt.
Givenchy? No. Or?
Hepburn did a musical. Coco.
Oh, Coco. Yeah.
She was in the sort of Coco Chanel uniform. Anyway, she just said she loved us both and she'd do anything we wanted and so on and so on. And
wow.
She didn't like her breasts, though, she warned us.
She did not like her breasts. Wow.
In the Russian tea room with people at the next table thinking, are you here
maybe she was talking about the chicken Kiev, the breasts that they were using for the dish, as opposed to her own. No, I'm kidding. Wow, that didn't get a laugh from Dick Cavett. I'm.
Her mind is unique. No, I am. I'm laughing on the inside.
Well, it was an inside joke. Yeah.
Marlon went on to tell her. I'm writing over that. Marlon went on to tell her that when I'm going to bed with girls with tits hanging their knees, tits that don't look like cross-eyed, ones are big and others, well, it doesn't matter. It doesn't make a bit of difference, he told her, and this seemed to make her feel better.
Okay.
She went back to her table, and we went back to our meal, and we said goodnight, and I left him off at the St. Regis, the Regency Hotel. I said, oh, by the way, her number was 274-3669. If you're not too tired.
Well, why didn't she? Well, if you knew her, but you had no desire either.
I'd forgotten it by then. I was too thrilled to be with Brando.
Oh, with Marlon. Were you guys friends, or just friends for that evening or something?
No, I got to know him pretty well, yeah.
So what was he like other times before he went really, crazy?
I can't really talk any more about right now, and you'll understand, because I'm writing about it.
Oh!
Part of the story will be, and this is all I can say about it, and you can Google the incident, it was in all the papers. The night he was on my show, hours later in dark Chinatown, he broke Ron Galella's jaw 8 inches from my face.
Wow. Okay.
And that's part of a good story.
Whew. Interesting stuff. Interesting. And we are talking, of course, with the one and only Dick Cavett. Do you have a little more time? Because I know we've already...
For those who don't know who the one and only Ron Galella is...
Was he a choreographer or a...
Famous paparazzo who was told to stay away from Mrs. Kennedy, remember, and all that kind of
stuff. Oh, that guy. Yeah, yeah. Wow, that's going back.
Documentary about Ron, and he really became the king of the paparazzi.
It was the first one that people knew by name. And Now, you...
My God, look, what have you done to me? I have 3.5 more minutes.
Oh gosh, 3.5 more minutes for Dick Cavett. Wow. All right, please, and I hate to do this to you, but...
My God.
Tell us,
a minute.
Your favorite... It could be on the air or off the air, but your favorite Groucho moment.
That girl just walked in.
What? Oh, the girl from the phone number. Wow. You lucky...
I'm kidding, of course.
Are her boobs...
her number, by the way, and Brando said, you son of a bitch, and laughed and went up the elevator.
No, all right, but tell us your favorite, it could be on the air or off the air, just in your private, in your lunches, in your meetings with him, a favorite Groucho moment.
Yeah, one of the great gifts of my life is that I not only met, but got to know and hang out with and have on my show numerous times, probably the most gifted comedian of our time. And I could easily defend that. And he... priceless. We would go to movies and go to plays and do stuff. Oh.
Yeah.
Being Groucho, leaving a party of a snooty Beverly Hills hostess one night and sneaking out through the French doors. But she sharp-eyedly walked over and said, oh, leaving so soon, Mr. Marks? And Groucho said, I've had a wonderful evening, but this wasn't it.
Well, I've had a wonderful time talking with Dick Cavett. This certainly was it, with all the puns and all the fun. And first of all, I invite you and pray that you will come back on the show other times, because there's so much more to talk about.
There's much more, yes.
And it's been, I hope you've enjoyed it, and I've had a thrill talking to you. Remember that you can see Dick Cavett online on the 13 website in Helman V. McCarthy from the Abingdon Theatre Company. He's in this full play, playing himself. And also, just tell people, what else are you working on? What else are you doing, and where can people see you elsewhere?
Let's see. I don't know. What day is this? Saturday?
Correct, yes.
So there are 3 airings for people in WNET area, in the area of Helman McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps you will supply people with the proper times.
If I can find them. And also, you were doing a blog for the New York Times last year. Are you still doing that?
Wait a minute.
What?
Isn't it on Sunday? tomorrow night?
That would be tomorrow night, yes.
Yeah.
So great. So beyond Hellman v. McCarthy, though, are you writing for anybody besides the book that you're working on? Is there a place where you're also appearing or in something?
I do temporarily from place to place. I may do the play in Los Angeles.
Oh.
For a few weeks.
Cool.
And that seems to be about to happen. And then, of course, I have my stitching at my embroidery hoop, my column for the New York Times online.
Oh, so you're still doing that? You were doing a monthly blog.
Yeah, it's a little less frequently now that they've changed things and fired 100 people. But, yeah, I will continue to do that. And then I have a book coming out in October, late October, of the last couple of years' columns. And it will be called, can you guess, Brief Encounters, fortunately with an S on the end of that, because the Noel Coward estate might sue for the movie
you can't copyright a title.
Years ago. I doubt that they checked and the phrase is not...
Right, it's not trademarked or anything. So cool. So yes, do keep reading Dick Cavett in the New York Times. Do see him in Hellman v. McCarthy. It has been an absolute delight. And the final question, at least for this interview, and I hope there will be future ones, with Dick Cavett, is you're 77 years old. You seem to be in terrific health, and also mentally and spiritually, you seem to be in a great place. What's on your quote-unquote bucket list for the next 10 or 20 years? What do you want to do?
Well, let's see. All I can think of is Woody Allen's hilarious answer to that question some decades ago. Can you name your greatest ambition or desire? And you have to be a certain age to get this, to know the name. He said, I can't tell you, but it has to do with Kate Smith. Do you get it?
Well, it's just funny to mention Kate Smith because she was a large...
Kate Smith was an icon, almost in life the size of the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah.
Wider. And it was just the image that it produced of Woody and Kate Smith intimate.
Oh, yeah. Well, who was the joke about aerial photographs of Kate Smith? Another comedian used that line, and that kind of broke me up.
That was also Woody.
Oh, that was Woody Allen. Oh, wow.
About her, but about maybe a date he got stuck with or something, who was so rotund she only showed up in aerial photographs.
Wow. I would love to keep you on much longer. I know you have to go, so...
Can't, you know, you can't.
I cannot. I absolutely cannot, but I pray that you will come back on with us very soon, because there's so much more to talk about with Dick Cavett. It's been, as I predicted, it's been a pleasure and an honor talking with you. Thank you so much for being...
I'll be the judge of that, but you make it quite painless, Lefkowitz.
Well, next time we'll do a threesome. I'll call up that girl. You still have that number. So, and we'll all get on the air together. How's that?
That'll be hot.
Indeed. Thank you, Mr. Cavett. Thank you so much.
Okay, Lefkowitz.
Bye-bye now.